A byproduct is an unexpected or unintended secondary product which occurs through the creation of a primary product. And while some of these byproducts are beneficial to our society, there are other byproducts which actually threaten the quality of our lives because they're harmful to our health. For example, toxic waste is oftentimes a byproduct of industrial manufacturing or other industrial processes. And being that this byproduct of toxic waste is so harmful to our health, the government has imposed many important regulations regarding the disposal of this harmful byproduct. And while toxic waste is a byproduct of industrial manufacturing, carbon dioxide is another harmful byproduct which is produced by the fuel combustion that occurs within our gasoline-powered automobiles. And since many suppose that this byproduct is harming our planet's atmosphere, car companies have been required by law to produce vehicles with less toxic emissions. And what about the toxic byproduct better known as secondhand smoke? You might not know this, but the secondhand smoke, which is produced by those who smoke cigarettes, actually presents a health risk to those who inhale the carcinogens and the chemicals which are present in this common byproduct. Without a doubt, the world is filled with many byproducts that are considered to be harmful to our health. And while many of these harmful byproducts are threatening the quality of our physical well-being, there are other harmful byproducts that occur within our hearts. Byproducts that end up threatening our spiritual well-being. A large percentage of these byproducts that I refer to, they're produced by the sins that stem from our own personal pride. And so with the products or the byproducts of our pride as our focus today, I'm going to open our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 14, where we find the pride of King Saul resulting in 5 harmful byproducts. As you find your way to 1 Samuel chapter 14, I want to set the stage for our study today by reminding you that the Philistines had invaded Israel. The enemies of Israel, the Philistines, they had invaded Israel, and as a result, King Saul found himself outgunned, outmanned, and outmaneuvered. And while Saul and the 600 men who made up the entire military, they had all but given up, they had thrown in the white towel, basically, Saul's son Jonathan at the same time took his armor bearer and they took the time to seek help from heaven. They prayed and sought the Lord if perhaps possibly the Lord might give them the victory over their enemy. Well, it was without telling his father that Jonathan and his armor bearer, they decided to go and invade the Philistine garrison. And with help from the King of Heaven, they turned the tables on this battle and they turned it in the favor of Israel. Well, this brings us to our text today, and so with this background in mind, if you would look with me there at 1 Samuel 14, I want to begin reading there at verse 16, because there we learn that the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time, the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened, while Saul talked to the priest, that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Well, let's stop right here and consider how here in these verses, we find King Saul. He's curious about the commotion that was coming from the Philistine garrison. And so Saul took his spies and he sent them out on this recon mission so that they might give a report about what was going on there in the camp of the Philistines. And according to these watchmen, the Philistine military, they were melting away, or in other words, they were scattering in every direction, which caused Saul to begin to question who in the world was leading this military campaign and who was causing all of this commotion? Who had gone into the camp of the Philistines and who was fighting against them? Well, we all know from reading our text last week that it was Saul's son Jonathan who was causing all this commotion. But Saul at this point in time was still unaware that his son had even left the camp, which is why he asked for the roll to be called. Look again there at verse 17. There we learn that Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who is gone from us." And when they had called the roll, notice that word surprisingly, they were surprised to learn that Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. In other words, Saul had discovered that his son Jonathan was the one who had invaded the garrison of the Philistines. And at that point in time, I am certain that Saul, being the loving father that he was very concerned about the well-being of his son. I can only imagine that he's thinking, man, Saul, his son Jonathan, he's thinking, what is my son doing? How is he going to escape this? He's going to die over there. And I'm certain that Saul became very concerned for the safety of his son. And so he called for help. He called for help from the high priest of Israel. Look again there at verse 18, because there we learn that Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here, for at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel." Now with this request in mind, we find Saul here. He's seeking guidance from God. He called for the high priest to come. He asked for the ark to be brought, and he's hoping that this high priest is now going to seek help from God to show them what they should do in order to help Jonathan out. And while this fatherly instinct was to just simply rush out and save his son, there was still the kingly concern of leading 600 men into battle against this massive military force of the Philistines. Remember, the Philistines had thousands and thousands of troops. And in order for Saul to rush in and help his son out, it would be taking 600 men to go fight against thousands and thousands of troops. And so Saul, he decided it's time to pray. It's time to seek God. However, before he received a response from heaven, Saul decided that he couldn't wait one more minute. And he told the priest actually to stop praying. Notice again there in verse 19, there we learn that it happened while Saul talked to the priest, that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." I can only imagine the priest reaching for the Ark of the Covenant to bring it near so that they could begin to sacrifice and pray to the Lord. And as he did, Saul heard the commotion growing and told the high priest, "Never mind. This whole prayer thing that we were about to engage in, don't worry about it. We got to go." Rather than spending some time seeking the Lord's will through prayer, Saul decided that he needed to hurry and go to the battle so that he might spare the life of his son. And from this, we see that Saul's pride was producing the byproduct of prayerlessness. He was so filled with pride to think that he was going to march in and that he was going to save his son's life and that by his power and with his military troops, he was going to be able to pull this whole thing off. That's just pride. He put prayer to the side. He said, "Never mind, God. I don't need to know what your answer is. I know what my answer is. I don't need to know what your will is. I know what my will is." And by his own power and according to his own will, Saul marched his troops into battle. Well, not only did Saul's pride become the byproduct of prayerlessness, but his pride also caused the byproduct of powerlessness, and that occurred within the ranks of his troops. With this in mind, I want to pick up in our text again. I want to begin there at verse 20, because there we learn that Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle, and indeed every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was a very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they had heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth-Aven. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. Well, here in these verses, we find the army of Israel. They're instantly increasing in size as Saul led his troops into battle. And this increase in size, it occurred in two different ways. And the first way is found there in verse 21, where we learn that the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. From this we learn that there were Israelites who had become slaves of the Philistines. At some point in time, whether it was at the beginning of this battle or at some other point in time in the past, these Israelites had become slaves of the Philistines, and it was those slaves who took up arms against their Philistine masters, and they fought alongside of Saul and Jonathan. And so this military force of the Israelites increased in size as these slaves took up arms. Not only that, but there in verse 22, we learn that all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim decided to rejoin the fight when they heard that the Philistines fled. But this all remind you that it was as the Philistines were marching into the land of Israel that almost, 2,000 or more troops from the military of Israel, they all fled. They went and dug holes. They hid in caves and under rocks. Well, now that the tide has turned, now that the Philistines are fleeing, those Israelites who had been afraid, those Israelites who ran and hid, now they're fighting alongside of the rest of the military there. And with a growing military force, the Israeli army pushed the Philistines back all the way to Beth Aven. Unfortunately, though, the troops were lacking the energy that they needed to continue fighting because they weren't even allowed to eat food until the entire battle was over. As a matter of fact, look with me there at verse 24, because there we learn that the men of Israel were distressed that day. For Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemy." So none of the people tasted food. From this we see that this army of Israel found themselves in a real catch-22 because they couldn't eat anything until the battle was over, but they couldn't really finish the battle because they hadn't eaten anything. And, if I'm in this military and I'm hearing King Saul saying, "Hey, you're not going to eat anything all day, but you're going to fight all day," I'm just going to say, "You know what? I'm out. I'm already hungry. I'm not going to not eat." Especially if you're out there fighting, you're burning calories, you need energy. It doesn't make good sense. Somebody should have spoken up, but they just listened and agreed, and they entered into this oath with Saul. As a matter of fact, look with me there at verse 25. Because there we learn that all the people of the land came to a forest, and there was honey on the ground. And when the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. Therefore he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand, and dipped it in a honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day,' and the people were faint. But Jonathan said, 'My father has troubled the land. Look now, how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines?'" Here in these verses, we learn that the Israeli army happened upon this beehive that was dripping with honey. And since they were desperately in need of something to replenish their energy, this honey was actually a perfect gift from God. You might not know this, but honey has actually been found to be one of the most effective carbohydrates to ingest prior to exercise. I actually carry honey-based energy chews with me in my Camelback whenever I go mountain biking, because within minutes of ingesting these things, I can feel an increase in energy, and it helps me to have the power that I need to complete the ride that I'm on. And so honey is just incredible for providing us with power and energy. And from this, we see then that God was clearly providing these men with a natural source of energy. Unfortunately for them, they were too afraid to eat any of that yummy honey, and the reason why is due to the fact that their king had sworn a curse on them. And he told them if they ate anything that day, before his vengeance was carried out on the Philistines, there would be a curse on them. Therefore, Jonathan was the only one in the whole military who ate anything that day. He ate some of that honey. And not out of disobedience. He wasn't acting out of disobedience against his father, but instead, he wasn't there when this oath was sworn. Remember, he was the one causing the commotion. He was already in the garrison of the Philistines, fighting against them by the power of God. So he wasn't around when Saul decided to make this oath that no one could eat all day. So he wasn't eating out of disobedience, but he was eating because it was the right thing to do. And he points out that his father had troubled all of Israel that day with this oath. And indeed he did. Notice again there at verse 27, where we're told that Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. Therefore he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in a honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. The translators of the New Living Translation put it like this: Jonathan ate the honey. After he had eaten it, he felt refreshed. Or another way to put it is like this: Jonathan ate the honey, and after he had eaten it, his strength was renewed. So with this, Jonathan had the power that he needed to continue fighting against the Philistines, but the rest of the army, they didn't. They were powerless. You see, after Jonathan ate the honey, he learned that his father had forbidden it. Notice again there at verse 28, where we find one of the people saying, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.'" Then at the end of that same verse, we see that the people were faint. That is to say that the people had become weak and powerless. And so we see that this second byproduct of Saul's pride, it was a powerless military. These troops had no power to continue fighting. And from this, if we interpret this in light of spiritual truths, we see then how pride will always rob us of the spiritual power that we need to fight against our spiritual enemies. The Christian who is filled with pride will not have the power that they need to stand against Satan and his demons. Well, not only did Saul's pride result in prayerlessness and powerlessness, but his pride also caused the byproduct of carelessness. With this in mind, let's look back at our text. I want to begin reading there at verse 31, because there we learn that Saul and his troops had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, so the people were very faint. And the people rushed on the spoil and took sheep, oxen, and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, "Look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." So he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day." Then Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep, slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Well, here in these verses, we find the army of Israel. They're starving. They're completely controlled by this insatiable appetite, so that they no longer even cared about the dietary laws that were clearly defined by God in the Levitical law. And rather than properly preparing the meat according to the Levitical law, they rushed upon the spoils of their victory. And this included the sheep and the oxen and the calves. And they slaughtered these animals right there on the ground, and they ate the meat with its blood, or in other words, they ate the meat raw. They did this despite the fact that the Lord had previously commanded them to drain the blood of an animal before eating its meat. I should remind you that these military men, they were so completely famished. And the reason why is because Saul made them swear an oath that they would not eat anything until he had taken his vengeance on his enemies. And while it's obvious that this oath was nothing more than a rash decree made by a pride-filled king, we must also consider how this prideful oath actually created the conditions which resulted in a famished army who ended up caring less, and they actually cared nothing about the dietary laws of God. And so Saul's pride and his prideful decision ended up causing carelessness in the hearts of his troops. And not only that, but Paul's pride was also causing carelessness in his own heart. And this carelessness is not only seen in the oath that created these conditions, but his carelessness can also be seen in his reaction to the report that the people were actually eating raw meat. With this in mind, notice again there in verse 33, where a group of men came to Saul and said, "Look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." Now, this should have been the time for Saul to search his own heart. This should have been the time for Saul to care enough to say, "What have I done?" look at the conditions that I've created for my troops. What have I done? This should have been the moment for him to finally recognize that his prideful desire for revenge had caused him to create a careless oath which resulted in famished men who were too hungry to care about the Levitical law of God. However, rather than repenting of his prideful ways, Saul carelessly shifted the blame to those who chose to eat the raw meat. Notice again there at the end of verse 33. There Saul declares, "You have dealt treacherously." Nothing about me. Nothing about what I did. No, just you. You have dealt treacherously. Or in other words, Saul was telling those who were eating the raw meat that they were being unfaithful to the Lord. Now, these men were certainly responsible for their own sinful decisions. Regardless of what Saul had decided, and regardless of the pride that was in Saul's heart, these men had the choice to, you know, clean this meat according to the Levitical law or eat the raw meat. And they chose wrong. They sinned against the Lord. And yet we must also agree that Saul was the one who was so filled with pride that he carelessly placed his desire for revenge before the well-being of his people. So they're responsible for the sins that they committed. However, Saul cared nothing. He could care less about the well-being of his troops and only cared about his revenge on the Philistines. And not only did Saul's pride cause him to make a careless decision, which created the conditions for the people's temptation to sin against God, but his pride also caused him to care less about his own culpability in this matter. As a result, rather than admitting that his prideful decision had led them into sin, he proudly placed himself upon his own pedestal. He placed himself upon a pedestal of self-righteousness, and he began to act like he was the only righteous one in the entire land. We see that there in the second half of verse 33, where Saul declares, "You have dealt treacherously, roll a large stone to me this day." You've done the wrong thing, and I guess I'm going to have to clean it up for you. That's basically what he's saying. Bring me a large stone, and I'll fix it. You bunch of sinners. And there in verse 34, Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.' So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord." Here in these verses, we find Saul, he's carelessly looking down on those who are sinning against the Lord. He wasn't saying, "Hey, we've all sinned here today. Let's repent before the Lord. Let's make this right. We're all wrong here today. Let's see if we can't come before the Lord and do things right." No, he wasn't taking that approach. He sat himself up on a pedestal and acted like he had done nothing wrong and that everyone else was being treacherous. He didn't come down to the same level with everyone else. He didn't see himself as a sinner, just like everyone else. He saw himself as the problem solver. And while he was correct to insist that they should all prepare their meat in the right way upon the right altar, he was also way too proud to take this opportunity to apologize for carelessly creating these conditions that led them to become so hungry that they were ready to eat raw meat. From this, we must understand then that pride, it will oftentimes create the byproduct of carelessness, which not only causes us to care less about the people around us, but it also causes the people around us to end up caring less about the God that we claim to worship. Well, not only did Saul's pride result in prayerlessness and powerlessness and carelessness, but his pride also caused the byproduct of mercilessness. With this in mind, if you would look back at our text, I want to begin reading there at verse 36. There in verse 36, we learn that Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. Then the priest said, let us draw near to God here. So Saul asked counsel of God. Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him that day. Well, here in these verses, we find Saul's military here. They're fully fed, and they're ready to continue this fight against the Philistines. And after proposing a plan to pursue and plunder the Philistines throughout the night, the people, they were on board with this plan, but the priest stepped in to provide Saul with a little wise counsel. And there at the end of verse 36, the priest proposed here that they draw near to God. And clearly that was through prayer. Well, in agreement with this, Saul took a moment to seek counsel from God. He said, okay, let's shoot up some quick prayers to God. And this led him to ask the Lord if the Lord was going to deliver the Philistines into the hand of Israel. And I'm going to guess here that Saul was just looking for this quick response. I'm going to say this quick prayer, and I'm going to look for the quick response so that we can get on the road and go. Unfortunately for Saul, God chose not to answer him that day. God didn't answer his prayer that day. It probably would have been good for Saul to say, okay, we're not moving forward until we hear from the Lord. It would have been good for Saul to just patiently wait or even consider, why is it that the Lord isn't answering my prayer? Well, that's what he decided to do, but he took a prideful approach at it. Rather than just waiting on the Lord's answer, Saul decided to force an answer out of God, and it was pride that began to produce this byproduct of mercilessness, and we find that here in our text. Look with me there at verse 38, where we learn that Saul said, come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not a man among all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, you be on one side, and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, give a perfect lot. So Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. It'll help us to understand here that this casting of lots was probably much like drawing straws or flipping a coin. During the days of the Old Testament, the children of Israel would cast lots in order to determine the will of the Lord. And since the Lord wasn't answering Saul's prayer about whether they should move forward or not, he decided that the Lord's silence was the result of someone else's sin. That's why there in verse 38 he says, come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. He's certain that God wasn't answering his prayer because someone has sinned. Therefore, he decided to cast these lots in order to determine the identity of the guilty party. And he began by separating himself and his son from the rest of the army. And he even said, you know, even if it's Jonathan who has sinned, someone's going to pay today. And he's saying even Jonathan will die today if he's the guilty one. Now, in this, I hear nothing of even if I am the one who has sinned. He's willing to argue that it's someone in the entire nation of Israel or in his military, quite possibly even Jonathan, but certainly not himself. There's no concept in his mind here that he possibly could be the guilty party. Yet I would suggest that he was so filled with pride that he couldn't even consider for one moment that it might have been his sin. Well, with this, he began by separating himself and his son from the rest of Israel. And according to the text here, well, Israel escaped. But he and his son were taken. And while he was quick to think that God's silence was somehow someone else's fault, the lot fell to him and Jonathan. I'm guessing that he was surprised when that happened. Well, beginning there at verse 42, we learn that Saul said, cast lots between my son and Jonathan and me. So Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. And Jonathan told him and said, I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, so now I must die? Saul answered, God do so and more also. "For you shall surely die, Jonathan." But the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Here in these verses, we find Saul, he's continuing to cast lots in order to identify the guilty party. And after the lot was cast, it was revealed that Jonathan was the one who had sinned against the king. And so Saul began to ask him, "What have you done?" And it's at this point that he learned that Jonathan had eaten honey in the woods. And notice again there in verse 43 where Jonathan admitted, "I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. So now I must die." Now as we consider Jonathan's defense, we must remember that he wasn't even present when his father Saul made this oath. He wasn't there when he made the entire military swear that they wouldn't eat until his vengeance was complete. And so while it's true that he had eaten that honey, it's also true that it was an act of ignorance, not an act of rebellion. Unfortunately for him, his father was so completely filled with pride that he was unable to show mercy to his son. Saul couldn't come to a conclusion that how can I hold him responsible for doing something that he had never been told not to? But his pride kicked in. He couldn't believe that his own son had sinned against him. And he was ready to claim Jonathan's life. Notice again there in verse 44 where Saul declared, "God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." Here in this kingly decree, we find a complete lack of mercy in the heart of Saul. He could have extended merciful forgiveness to his son, but he didn't. Saul was being ruled by the pride in his life, and as a result, it was producing the byproduct of mercilessness. Well, thankfully for Jonathan, the military stepped in and spared his life. They began to make sense out of this whole thing. They reminded Saul how the Lord had used Jonathan that day to deliver the nation of Israel from the Philistines. They reminded Saul, "Hey, he's not a sinner like you're accusing him of. He was the one who saved us today." So Saul relented from harming his son, and yet the fact still remains that Saul was filled with mercilessness. And from his example, we must understand that pride will always produce the byproduct of mercilessness in our lives. Pride in our hearts becomes unforgiveness towards others. And God forbid someone cross our prideful path. Because if they do, then there's no mercy for them if we're ruled by our pride. Well, not only did Saul's pride result in prayerlessness and powerlessness and carelessness and mercilessness, but his pride also resulted in the byproduct of friendlessness. And with this in mind, look back at our text. I want to begin reading there at verse 46. There we read that Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he harassed them. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. The sons of Saul were Jonathan, Jeshui, Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimez. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now there was fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or valiant man, he took him for himself. Well, here in the final verses of this chapter, we learn that it was after this battle against the Philistines was over that Saul further established his sovereignty over Israel. And that's to say that Saul continued to fight against the enemies of Israel, and he chased them out of the promised land in all directions. He was pushing them out of the promised land and defeating them left and right. And there at the end of verse 47, we learn that Saul was harassing the enemies of Israel, and he delivered his nation from the hands of those who plundered him. And so in this text here, we find a list of names. And it's a list of Saul's enemies. This was a list of those who had become the enemies of Israel, and therefore the enemies of King Saul. But we not only find a list of Saul's enemies, we also find a list of Saul's family members. And here in the final verses of this chapter, we find this list of Saul's immediate family, which included his sons, his daughters, and his wife, not to mention his uncle and father. Finally, we also see a list of men, not named, but there in the final verse of this chapter, we learn that Saul took every strong and valiant man for himself. And so here in this text, we find these three groups that surrounded Saul: his enemies, his family members, and those who were serving under his authority. As we consider the relationships that we find mentioned in these verses, the one thing that seems to be missing in Saul's life, well, it's godly friendships. I see no real mention here of any godly friendships that Saul had. That's right. Saul was a man who had a wife and kids, and he was surrounded by those under his authority, as well as he was surrounded by those who were his enemies. However, there's absolutely no mention of any comrades or any buddies or any close companions who were there to support him and even guide him through difficult decisions. And while I know that this is nothing more than an argument from silence, there's no text that says Saul had no friends. It's not there. But the absence of any list of friends leads me to deduce at least that Saul was probably a friendless guy. It seems obvious to me that Saul was a man who had no close friends, and not that there's any mention of friends here in this text today, but as we continue to study through the book of 1 Samuel, we really never find any mention of his friends. Now, don't get me wrong. I know that our spouse should be our best friend. Those of us who are married here today, we should have a best friend in our spouse. And so we can only hope here that Saul had a best friend in his wife, Ahinoam. And yet at the same time, it's important for every person to understand that, you know, our best friend in our spouse doesn't really fulfill all of the friendship needs that we have. I can tell you this morning that Brenda, my wife, she is my best friend. I hope she would say the same vice versa. I'm sure she does. But the fact is, Brenda's a girl, I'm a guy, and I oftentimes don't understand where she's coming from, and she often does not understand where I'm coming from. I don't get the issues of women, which is one reason why I don't spend much time counseling women. We have a women's ministry who understands what women are going through, and they can provide better spiritual counsel to women than I could. And women, you need other women in your life, good, godly friends that you can lean on and seek spiritual support from. And guys, same for you. You need godly men in your life who can support you spiritually and enter into those iron sharpening iron relationships that won't really occur between you and a woman. And this is what is missing in Saul's life. I don't see any mention of him having these godly men surrounding him and supporting him spiritually. And while I know this is only a logical deduction from silence, I've personally come to the conclusion that Saul's pride had left him friendless. And the reason why is due to the fact that pride destroys friendships. That's really what it comes down to. Pride destroys friendships. And from Saul's example, we must understand that those who are filled with pride might find themselves surrounded by family members and co-workers, but their friend list is probably pretty short. And the reason why is due to the fact that friendliness, well, it's typically not experienced in the life of someone who is so completely filled with pride that they care nothing about the people around them. And so a byproduct of pride, well, it's friendlessness. Well, in order to learn how we might avoid all of the byproducts that we've studied here in our text today, if you would turn with me to Luke chapter 14. Because as we conclude our study today, I want to take some time to consider how we can avoid these byproducts of pride. And as you turn to Luke 14, we should take a moment to consider some of the warnings that God presents to us in His Word about pride. For example, Solomon reveals to us that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. And not only that, but he also revealed how a man's pride will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor. James tells us that God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And the Apostle John warned us that the pride of life will produce many sins in our life. Well, from this we see then that God is clearly opposed to those whose hearts are filled with pride. And here in Luke 14, we find Jesus, he's encouraging his disciples to avoid the pride that would cause them to exalt themselves. He did this with a parable, and so let's begin reading this parable, beginning there at verse 7, where we find Jesus telling a parable to those who were invited when he noted how they chose the best places, saying to them, "When you are invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, 'Give place to this man,' and then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, go up higher.' Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Here in these verses, Jesus helps us to see that those who are so filled with pride that they would go in and take the best seat in the house, those are those who are choosing to exalt themselves. And those who choose to exalt themselves will eventually be humbled, much like King Saul will eventually be humbled as we continue studying through this text. You see, as we continue to study the life of King Saul, we're going to watch as God humbles him. He will continue to grow in his pride. He will continue to exalt himself. And God will eventually come along and humble him and raise up King David to take over his place. From this, we have to understand that if we want to avoid the humbling that comes from the holy hand of God, then we must decide that we're going to humble ourselves in the sight of God. Because this gives God space to exalt us in His timing and according to His will. When we enter into a situation and we place ourselves up on top of the pedestal, the only place God can take us from there is down. And He will. He will humble us so that we will understand what Jesus was teaching here. But when we simply take the lowest place and humble ourselves, well, the only place that God can take us from there is up. And He will, according to His will. As we consider all of this, it's possible that you're struggling this morning to consider whether or not you're filled with pride. You're considering, you know, am I struggling in the same way? Do I have the same sort of pride that filled the heart of Saul? And in order to diagnose the level of pride that may or may not be in your own heart, then simply ask yourself, am I a prayerless person who sees prayer as a last resort? When there's trouble in my life, do I do everything I can to try to solve that problem, and then when all else fails, then I pray? If that sounds like you, then the chances are you have pride in your heart which is producing the byproduct of prayerlessness. And if you're a person who feels like they lack the spiritual power that you need to serve the Lord in the way that He's calling you to serve, then the chances are you have pride in your heart. And that pride is producing the byproduct of powerlessness. If you make careless decisions that create the conditions for others to sin against the Lord, then it's possible that you have pride which is producing the byproduct of carelessness. And if you have a hard time providing merciful forgiveness to those who cross you or do you wrong, then the chances are you have the pride that is producing the byproduct of mercilessness. Finally, if you're unable to point to a few friends who are of the same gender who you can lean on for spiritual support and accountability, then the chances are you have pride, which is producing the byproduct of friendlessness. Christian, listen, if any of these pride-based byproducts are found in your life this morning, then the chances are you have pride in your heart. But I don't mean for that to discourage you, because I'm here to tell you that we all struggle with pride of some sort. We all struggle with the pride of life to some degree. And with that being the case, then I would leave you with the words of Jesus, who encouraged us to simply humble ourselves. Let's choose to humble ourselves so that we might be exalted by our loving Lord and Savior. And as we humble ourselves, then we'll soon discover that we're no longer producing the byproducts of pride. And as we humble ourselves, we'll rid ourselves of the prayerless, powerless, careless, merciless, and friendless byproducts that come from a heart that's filled with pride. Let's pray.